who carried those germ cells. So Weissman did this experiment. He said, if Lamarck is right and the environment influences the expression of heredity, then he said, if I cut the tails off of mice and then mate these tailless mice with each other, the environmental influence of cutting the tails off should be acquired by the offspring. They should inherit this so that the offspring of these mated tailless mice should be tailless. Well, of course, he did the first run of experiments and he mated them, and the offspring had tails. So he said, well, I'll give the benefit of the doubt here. He ran the experiment 21 times, taking the offspring from one set of experiments, mating them, cutting their tails off, then mating them, and then cutting the offspring from that cross, cutting their tails off and mating them 21 times, 21 generations. At the end of 21 generations, he stopped the experiment saying, look, every time I cut the tails off, I mate the mice and the new babies all have tails. Lamarck has to be wrong. None of these mice inherited taillessness. There's only one problem, of course. We bought the experiment and wrote Lamarck off, but in hindsight, there was one big flaw in all this, or actually a couple of big flaws. One of them, Lamarck said evolution took thousands of years. So 21 generations is not really an accurate experiment. If Weissman would do it for 1,000 years, maybe in 1,000 years, actually, tailless mice may have been born. That's possible. But another flaw in the experiment was this. Lamarck said that traits that were no longer necessary, or traits that were ineffective, would be the ones that would be altered. Just because Weissman thought the tails and the mice were not necessary didn't reflect the fact that maybe the mice thought the tails were necessary. So his cutting off the tails didn't affect the heredity, because the tails play a useful functional part in the life of the mouse. So for those two reasons, Weissman's experiments are really not very good science. Yet people were already desirous to prove Charles Darwin's theory, and that was a competing theory. So when Weissman did this experiment, it said, okay, let's get rid of Lamarck, and now we're left with Darwinian theory, which is the theory based on chance, versus Lamarck, who had a completely different theory and said organisms and their environment are in a lockstep interaction. As the environment changes, so will the organism to accommodate those changes. So that evolution was an interactive process between the organisms on the planet and the environment, and it was a dynamic, instructive event. Well, since that time where we got rid of Lamarck and made a buffoon, everyone used to talk about Lamarck as the crazy guy who suggested that fish are at the edge of the pond and daydreaming about the fact that if they could get legs, they could walk out there. And that's the old Lamarck joke, a fish pondering the idea of legs and wishing itself to have legs. And this was what was attributed to Lamarck, when Lamarck never said that. And it was interesting, because Lamarck's study on the relationship of the environment, he also said something that was very critical back in 1809. So that was, almost 200 years ago. He said this very precisely. He said that the more humans separate themselves from nature, the greater will be our disruption and social loss. And it's interesting, because this is exactly where we've come from, because buying into the Darwinian theory says that everything was an accident, that nothing was really connected with anything else. It was just a matter of genes accidentally being misread, providing for different organisms. And we have essentially divorced ourselves from the environment. We have done that both through the church, who said, oh, man was put on top of this planet after everything was here, so that everything was here for us to mess around with. And biology continued that separation by saying, well, you got here by accident. There was no purpose for you to be here. So that's just the way it is. And we're all a bunch of random people in a random world. And yet what we're really beginning to find out is that this is not really true, that evolution is involving a very, very big and major cooperative effort among and within all of the organisms on this planet. Timothy Lenton, an evolutionary biologist from Great Britain, has revealed very interesting data that, in fact, evolution is not based on Darwinian competition, where there's a struggle and the survival of the fittest is what's important. That Lenton reveals that evolution is based totally on cooperation, that nature itself doesn't really care who's the strongest in any particular group. Nature cares what the group does. So while in our Darwinian mind, we look for who's going to be the strongest human, and in nature's mind, what are humans doing to the planet? There's two different events. And the issue is that, because as a group, we have been consistently destroying the planet. Nature has a vision that says that anything that doesn't fit in harmony with the environment has to be removed from the environment. And unfortunately, we are deep into our sixth mass extinction because of the exact problem that Lamarck warned us about. We cannot separate ourselves from the environment. We are the environment. We are not separate from anything in the environment. In order for us to survive, we need bacteria. As a matter of fact, right now, wherever you are, you have bacteria in your gut that are not you. They're from the outside. But without them, you wouldn't live. These bacteria not only provide fundamental nutrients and vitamins to our survival, these bacteria even control the genes that are active in your gut cells. We live in a community. Everything is a community, except our human hubris has us sitting on top, saying that we're in charge of everything and we can do what we want. That hubris itself is responsible for the problems that we have, in addition to the Darwinian theory, which says that this is all a struggle and that survival of the fittest is what counts in a world where it's based now, where you recognize on cooperation and not competition. We also recognize something very, very new that's very important in regard to the concept of genetic engineering. It was our original premise and understanding of DNA that DNA occurs within an individual cell. It is not connected to anybody else. That the DNA in you is your DNA and the DNA in some other organism is somebody else's DNA. And what we now recognize is something called horizontal and vertical transfer. That we now recognize that organisms exchange DNA and that this is a normal way of life because DNA represents an acquired learning of the environment and that organisms can pass them among each other so that we can get DNA from one human to another human, but we can also get DNA from organisms that are greatly different species that we find in our human genome. A lot of bacterial genes, that bacteria in our gut, are greatly influencing us. Why is this relevant? Because today we're dabbling with genetic engineering, the concept that we can just take any organism out there, and because of our conventional belief, remember that mission statement of science, to dominate and control nature, and our ability to change genes, that we can just take any organism and change the genes to create whatever we want. In so doing, we've created a great deal and variety of genetically engineered crops. What we're really not talking about is what is the consequence of putting those crops into the real world? And the answer is through genetic transfer. We now find that the genes that we put into certain genetically engineered organisms are moving through the ecosystem and being picked up by other organisms. That what were efforts to make plants resistant to a poison that was going to kill all the weeds with a special gene that would make the plant immune to that poison, they found that the plants have passed the genes on to all the other plants around them in the field. So that, guess what? We have now created what are called super weeds. Weeds that have incorporated those particular immune-conferring genes and no longer can be killed by the normal poisons that are out in agriculture. Again, the point about all this is that genetically engineered organisms are part of a community and share their genes. It has also been recognized that when we eat genetically modified foods, the bacteria in our gut that digest those foods can also pick up and incorporate genetically engineered genes. So we're even changing the genetic organization of the bacteria within our own gut from eating genetically modified foods. Where this is going to lead to, unfortunately, is issues that humans never really expect to find until something hits the wall. So, for example, there was a day when it was great to have all this radioactive material and all this waste matter from nuclear plants. And then somebody said, well, what are you going to do with this stuff? Oh, we're going to put it in concrete bunkers in the ground, and it will last millions of years until the radioactivity is all gone. Only unfortunate part about that is exactly we made the bunkers, but nobody considered the fact that the bunkers over time cracked, and all of the radioactivity started leaking back into the environment again. The same thing applies with genetic engineering, where they said, oh, well, these genes are not going to affect this organism. We're now beginning to recognize that the genes are passed from one organism to another. So for us to mess with nature is sort of like throwing a monkey wrench into a highly designed, geared mechanism. We can destroy this whole thing. The problem is we will probably only find out about that destruction when the effects are so bad that they become very obvious to us. Yet we already know that's the direction and that engineered genes are not restricted to the organism in which they were engineered, but now go out into the field. So we come to this third conclusion about the perception, and that is this: the switches on the surface of the membrane, conclusion one, the switches control the proteins which control our behavior. Number two, the switches control the regulatory proteins of chromosomes, and so the perception switches control which genes are going to be read. And now number three, we recognize that when the perception of the organism identifies stresses it can no longer deal with, then what's going to actually happen is that the perception of the stress will go into the genetics and actually lead to a rewriting of the code via hypersomatic mutation, lead to a change out of the genes in an effort to adjust the organism to accommodate the environment in which it finds itself. So really what it says is perception controls behavior, perception controls activity of genes, and perception even controls the final readout of the genetic code. And all of these become relevant because all of us are dealing with our lives the same way cells do. We are exactly the same. We read the environmental signals via our skin, which is the equivalent of the cell membrane. We adjust our biology, our behavior from those perceptions. We adjust which genes we activate with those perceptions. And unfortunately, because we hadn't known it in the past, that when we are stressed, our perceptions can also lead to a rewriting of our genetic code. And this is problematic considering that 95% or more of us got here with an appropriate genetic code to survive and thrive on this planet. If we rewrite those genes via misperceptions, stresses that we generate that are not really real, but we buy into them, then we'll even change our genetic code. And this comes to very big issues concerning itself with cancer and the expression of cancer in our planet and genetic defects that arise in the life of an individual. And that our genes change from a day-to-day basis on which ones are being read. This is a very interesting result of new studies that also revealed that identical twins, when they're born, essentially have pretty much the same genes being read in their genome. But from day they start living life and experiencing the planet, they start diverging so that the older they get, when you compare their genes, which ones are being read, they become greatly different. That the readout of one twin is going to have a different readout of genes than the other twin. And it's all now recognized to be based on experiences. As we experience life, we change the genes that are being read. And this is nature's sense of survival, because if environments change, you have to change the programs. And so it was built in to do that. So now we have to deal with the concept of perceptions. Perceptions are the mechanism by which an environmental signal is interpreted and then activate a biological function to meet the demand of those perceptions. Well, when we talk about perceptions, we can actually consider perceptions in two fundamental ways. Perceptions, part one, are things. I perceive a microphone that I'm talking into. I perceive a room. I perceive a window. I perceive a rug. Wherever you are, you can perceive things all around you. Perceptions are identities of things. I can perceive things as being this or being that. But what's interesting about perceptions are not just identities, because when we acquire perceptions, we also give them a survival value. That if something is dangerous, I need to know that when I learn it, so if I ever see it again, I enact and do the appropriate response to stay alive. So when we acquire perceptions, we give them values for survival. So then if I say, well, wait a second, perceptions get between the environment and the cells and control the cells. The perceptions are the substance and function of the nervous system. The nervous system is designed to read the environment, integrate all the incoming information, perceptions, and then engage appropriate functional and physiological behaviors to keep us alive in that particular field. So then I say, okay, survival is the primary function of using our perceptions to survive. And I say, well, wait, what does survival really represent? Again, for simplicity, I can divide survival into two fundamental components. Survival can consist of, one, the mechanisms of growth and reproduction, meaning this: in order for you as an individual to survive, you have to grow and keep yourself alive and take care of your system, which is a process called growth. To keep the species alive, you have to reproduce. You actually have to reproduce your own cells just to stay alive. So our survival is very much tied in with growth and reproduction. Now, I'm not talking about the growth that occurs between a neonate and adult. I'm talking about the requirement of this growth and reproduction for your entire life. I don't care how many hundred years old you are, for this simple reason. As I mentioned when we really started this program a long time ago, is that the human body is a community of cells, upwards to 50 trillion cells. Every day in our normal use, we are losing cells. There's a great attrition. Maybe billions of cells every day are lost because they age, they wear out, they die. Well, that's a very interesting fact because it says, and you must grow every day to replace these cells. If you interfere with growth, if you stop growth, a person can die because there's a point if I start losing too many cells, that attrition will affect some of my functions, causing them to stop functioning, let's say, and causing me to die. So survival is very much tied in with growth every day of our lives just to keep us alive in the face of the number of cells that we lose every day as a result of normal attrition. Okay, so it becomes important that growth is a very, very functional part of our survival. But another part of our survival uses mechanisms other than those used in growth. A completely different set of mechanisms are used for the second component of survival. The second component is called protection. Protection and growth are not the same thing at all. They, as I said, they use completely different mechanisms and for different reasons. Growth is to open up to the outside and take things in, assimilate things, and incorporate them into your life. Protection is completely the opposite. Protection is to shut you down and prevent things that are threatening from the outside from getting in and destroying you on the inside. So I am engaging in both growth and protection mechanisms every moment of my life and funding each of these with energy because it takes energy to grow. It takes energy to protect yourself. But now here comes a very interesting fact. In survival, when we go back into ancient times, yes, there were indeed times you needed protection. To run away from that saber-toothed tiger, for example, required a protection movement. So what would happen is the system was designed to be in growth and then occasionally be in protection for the moment you had to run away from that tiger. But once you ran away from the tiger and you survive, you go back into growth again. Protection cannot be a sustained life event for this very particular reason. When we engage in protection mechanisms, by nature, we have to close ourselves down. That's what protection is all about, and we begin to shut off growth. Nature designed us to use protection in acute responses, again, like running away from the saber-toothed tiger. But if you maintain protection and you keep it for too long, you compromise your survival because in a state of protection, you are actually shutting off the growth mechanisms as you engage in closing yourself down and putting your energy into reserves for fight or flight. And so as a result, what really becomes important is this: how much of our lives are in growth and how much of it is in protection? And here's a simple basic understanding regarding the use of energy. As I mentioned, it takes energy to grow. It takes energy to protect yourself. And the point is this: the more fear that we live in, the more we allocate our energy into protection, but you get that energy by taking it away from growth. So in fact, the more afraid you become, the more you shut down growth, to the extent that this becomes a truism. You can be scared to death. And the reason why that happens is something that promotes so much fear actually can cause your physiology to shut itself down, and you can actually die from being in a protection response. And the issue is that in the world that we live in today, protection responses become a greater and greater percentage of our everyday life experience, to the extent that most of us are living on very high levels of stress and are continuously debilitating our system by interfering with growth. But to talk about that, let's first talk about the relationship between growth and protection using a simple experiment that I saw in my own tissue culture cells, and that's simply this. I take two sets of cultures. with cells in them, and I put in one set of culture, some food and nutrients in a certain spot on the Petri dish. In the other set of cultures, in that very same spot, I put toxins. And now I have these two sets of dishes, and I put them back in the incubator, and I come back hours later, and I ask a question, where are the cells going to be? And I bet you can already begin to figure it out. In the dish where the food was, when the cells perceive, which remember is reading the environment, and perceive the nutrients, the cells adjust their biology to move to the food. So wherever the Petri dishes are, when I put food in that spot, when I come back, the cells are going to be all gathered around that food and participating in growth. In the parallel set of cultures, I put toxins. But when the perception of the cells reveals the presence of the toxin, rather than moving to the toxin, that perception causes cells to move in the opposite direction, away from it, for protection. So the cells in those dishes are going to be on the far end of the Petri dish, away from the source of the toxins, trying to avoid the toxins and stay alive. What's the point? It's simply this. When the perception is recognized to be of things that support growth, the cells will move to the perceptions that support growth. When the perceptions are recognized as things that threaten survival, then the cells will move away from those perceptions. So there's an interesting reality. There are perceptions that cause us to move to them in a state of growth, which is being open so we can assimilate those things. And there are perceptions of things that threaten us, that cause us to be concerned about our survival. And when we perceive those signals, we move away from the signal and close ourselves down. They're diametrically opposed behaviors. One perception, move to the stimulus, arms open, taking it in. The other perception, identify the threatening stimulus, move away from it, and close yourself down in a state of protection. That little simple experiment leads to a very important fact. Cells cannot move in both directions at the same time. That at the level of cells, cells are either in growth, open to the environment and assimilating what's going on, or cells are in protection, shutting themselves down, waiting for the environment to clear itself before again expressing its normal functions. The issue about this is that when we perceive the world that we live in, we interpret the perceptions. As I said, all perceptions are interpreted in regard to identities of things. But we didn't recognize was this. We also attribute to each perception when we learned it a survival value. So if we see something threatening, then our tendency is to move away from it and shut ourselves down. And if we see something that supports what we consider growth, we'll move toward that perception and incorporate it and take it in. Well, this all of a sudden says, well, there's this great A-B kind of switch. You're either in growth or you're in protection. Well, if you're a cell, that's very true, because cells can't move forward and be open and move backwards and be closed at the very same time. And yet, what we do is we live in a community of cells, and the community of cells responds to the perceptions generated by our central nervous system. So it becomes very interesting then that our perceptions are programmed and our cells respond to the programs of perceptions that our central nervous system experiences. So let's go first over the concept of growth and protection and how they're mutually exclusive to each other. And it works like this. I said cells form a community, and the community is an organism. So we are, in a sense, a large community of individual living cells. But a cell community is just like a community made out of people. So to give the story, then, I'll talk about people, but it's the same for cells. And it goes like this. In the old days, we thought the Russians were going to bomb us. So what did we do? We built bomb shelters. And so let's consider a nice little town where you're living right now, wherever it is, and you recognize on a wonderful, you know, spring day, the weather's fine, the plants are growing, the businesses are open, they're doing businesses, the factories are open, they're growing, they're assimilating things and turning them into products, schools are going, education, we're in a state of growth, and everyone is thriving at this moment. But all of a sudden, there's an air raid siren, and when the air raid siren comes, everybody runs to their bomb shelter. Well, I have a couple of questions to ask about this behavior. Number one, if everything was growing when we were engaged in the job. When everybody went to the bomb shelter, what happened to the processes of growth? What about the businesses that were producing and the stores that were open and the schools that were teaching? In the moment of protection, when we all ran to the bomb shelter, growth stopped. There was nobody on the job making things at the factory. School was empty. Businesses were closed.